You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
The name of the panel is called Encryption, Balancing Privacy, Security, and Law Enforcement Needs. It's basically an encryption issue. A lot has been happening in the press. You're probably all aware of this. We have a great panel of some issues at play, both the House and the Senate, the courts, and elsewhere. I will also note that timing-wise, last night, House Energy and Commerce Committee and the House Judiciary Committee, Chairman Goodlatte released a notice about putting together an encryption work group, Joint Committee of Energy and Commerce and Judiciary. So Chairman Goodlatte is also the Chairman of the Congressional Internet Caucus, so I want to bring that to your attention. And with that, let me just also say, housekeeping, and for you, for those of you who come here regularly and hear my spiel, I apologize, but this event is hosted in conjunction with the Congressional Internet Caucus itself. The Congressional Internet Caucus will be turning 20 years old this coming summer. And if you try to remember where you were 20 years ago when we first started doing these things, it would be interesting thoughts or considering the issue at play today. The co-chairs of the Congressional Internet Caucus on the House side are Chairman Bob Goodlatte, Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, and on the Senate side, the co-chairs of the Internet Caucus are Senator John Thune and Senator Patrick Leahy. And we want to thank them for supporting these briefings that we do and trying to do a fair broker more conversations and debate about an important internet issue, which this certainly is the one. The hashtag for today is #CryptoBalance. That's #CryptoBalance. And you can follow us at NetCaucusAC. The Twitter account is at NetCaucusAC. We'll be posting the audio of this event after the conclusion within about 20 minutes. And then other photos and things like that, you can join the conversation there. So let me introduce our moderator, which is Chris Rome from Bloomberg News, and Chris is a reporter there, and he's been following this issue quite closely, and we'll walk you through the panel. So thanks, Chris.
All right, thanks a lot, everyone, for being here. Really appreciate it. I will just do a quick introduction to the panel. We are thrilled to have the experts that we have today. We have Matthew Green, assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University, and then we have Susan Hennessy, who's a fellow of National Security and Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, Kevin Mangston, director of the Open Technology Institute at the New America Foundation, and Richard Downey, deputy assistant attorney general, the acting deputy assistant attorney general for the Criminal Division at the U.S. Department of Justice. So we'll get into the issues in just a minute. I just want to give a quick background overview, kind of state of play of where things are at. This encryption issue kind of really burst onto the public scene for a lot of people in February when the FBI went to Apple with a court order compelling the company to access one of the phones that was used in the terrorist attack in San Bernardino last December. Apple refused. Apple pushed back and said that it would violate their constitutional rights to comply and that they would have to write new software in order to be able to have them. In March, the FBI actually backed down. At the last minute, they said that an unnamed third party came forward with a solution, a hacking tool to be able to break into the phone, and they no longer needed Apple's assistance. And so they were able to get into the phone without Apple's assistance. But at the same time, there's been another court case that has been ongoing. Last fall, there's a court case in Brooklyn, New York, where law enforcement is trying to get access to a phone and another iPhone, and they went to the court to compel Apple last fall. And the court actually did something kind of unique, and they said they went to Apple and asked if Apple should be compelled to assist law enforcement under the broad Aldridge Act. And Apple actually pushed back and said, no, we don't think we should. So the court never even granted an order. So the Justice Department is now appealing that and trying to get the court to actually give the order to Apple in that specific case. But the issue of encryption is much bigger than just the issue of encrypted phones. This goes back a few decades even, but a few years ago with the Edward Snowden revelations, more and more companies began to move toward encryption, whether it was encrypted phones, or whether it was encrypted apps, encrypted communications, and that has presented a lot of challenges for law enforcement. So more and more we have companies that have been moving toward giving their users and customers control of the encryption, and some companies that don't even keep information about their users. And that brings us to where we are today, with a very, very public battle that's taking place right now between law enforcement and the technology community and the privacy community. And so, so we're very thrilled to have the expert panel, the panel of experts that we have to discuss this issue. And I just wanted to open it up by asking Matt maybe just to explain just briefly, you know, what encryption is and why it's so important, and then we'll go to Richard to talk about the challenge that law enforcement is facing with encryption and kind of the legal process that law enforcement uses in order to go after encrypted data. And then we'll turn to Susan and Kevin to talk about the legal and policy issues that are underlying these issues. So, Matt?
Okay, my name is Matthew Green. I'm a professor of computer science at Johns Hopkins. Sorry about that. I happen to study a very esoteric field, which many people didn't think about very much, and all of a sudden has now become national news. You hear about it in presidential debates, which is very strange for me. I study applied cryptography, which is the study of essentially taking information, transforming it to forms that are, in many cases, much more challenging for people to read, and then, in some cases, transforming them back. The area that I've been focusing on over the last several years is end-to-end encryption. Now, I want to give a very brief explanation of what encryption is and why end-to-end encryption is special before we go on with this panel. We have had encryption in our systems for many years. In fact, you've used encryption dozens of times today, whether you knew it or not. If we shut down encryption on the internet or on our cellular networks or payment systems, pretty much society as we know it would stop functioning. So nobody is here to debate whether encryption is a good thing or not. However, in the last several years, a few things have changed. One of those things is that we have now developed portable devices like this one that give us the ability to actually perform encryption directly end-to-end, from myself to my friends. I can encrypt a message so that only myself and my friend can read it, or even just from myself to myself. I can encrypt my phone using a passcode so that I'm the only person who can decrypt that phone. And so this is actually, you know, the technology, the mathematics behind this has been known for years. You can buy a book that gives the algorithms for doing this. But what's changed is all of a sudden in the last several years, people are actually starting to use this technology at reasonably high rates. So the question, obviously, that we're running into now is now that this technology, which has been around for years, is being used by 50% of the world instead of maybe 2% of the privacy enthusiasts of the world, what should we do about this? What exactly, you know, how safe is it for individuals to have the ability to send each other messages without law enforcement and other intermediaries being able to read them? Up until recently, and I'm not a lawyer here, I'm the least legally trained person here, but the belief was that encryption was kind of unstoppable, that it was math. There was nothing you could do to stop it. People would implement it themselves. If you tried to stop it, you'd basically be holding back innovation. And so in the 1990s, when we had a version of this debate, the ultimate conclusion was that, well, let's let people develop and deploy encryption, and we'll see what happens. The results were mostly good. Now we're having essentially a redo of this argument. Now that encryption is not 2%, but 60% of the world, we're having an argument about whether we've made a mistake. The last thing that I kind of want to say before I kick off the rest of this panel is that the real question here, the technological question that interests me, is whether it's actually possible to deploy encryption in a form that allows other intermediaries to read it. This is one of the biggest challenges. There's a political debate to be had here, but there's also a technological debate. Encryption is designed to protect information. If I deploy encryption in a form that allows somebody else to read it, it's not really encryption anymore. And so the question is, can I build secure phones? Can I build secure messaging systems that actually allow law enforcement to intercept without also allowing criminals to do the same? So far as technologists, we don't really know how to do this, which is why the current debate over the legality of encryption is so challenging to us. But, you know, we'd like to hear proposals for doing it, at least from law enforcement and from others in Congress, before we kind of roll this out. So I hope that this is a good explanation or introduction to the problem.
Richard? Go ahead.
So what I would like to talk a little bit about is the impact that this has on law enforcement activities and the mission that we have in order to try to solve crimes, bring people to justice, and keep the public safe. This comes up in two forms in general, as sometimes stored devices that are at rest, so-called data at rest, where we need to get access to that for purposes of investigation, and sometimes it comes up in the form of data in motion, that is, intercepting communications that are happening between two different people. The way we come up with an investigation, most generally, is that law enforcement would obtain a search warrant in order to access that data, let's say, if it's at rest. It's a stored device that somehow comes into the hands of law enforcement. And the steps that those are gone through is that the officer would write a long affidavit that explains to the court the reasons for the need to go into the phone. He has to establish what's called probable cause, so a significant burden to prove that this is indeed a place where evidence will be located. It's the standard that they would use to obtain a search warrant and enter someone's home. That application is then brought first to a prosecutor and then to a court, usually a magistrate judge in the federal system, and the magistrate judge who is not involved in the investigation reviews the facts and decides whether, on balance, it is appropriate for the government to have access to that information. This is, of course, the long system that we've had in this country for centuries. It's controlled by the Constitution, and in the case of interceptions, there's even more layers added on top of that, including the approval of a very senior person within the Department of Justice. You have to show the court that you tried everything else, and this is the last resort. And even after that, there are what are called minimization rules, which means that you have to cull out material that is not relevant to the investigation. So the question is, at the end of this process, where a judge has made this ruling and decided that it is appropriate to get access to that stuff, will the evidence be available to the government, to the law enforcement officer at that point, and whether the encryption is the thing that will block it? And I think what's this is all sort of useful and abstract in a way, but I think it's useful to think about particular examples of how this would come up, so that we can really think hard about the costs that are being imposed as a result of these encryption decisions. I, by no means, intend this to be any sort of scare tactic, but it's practical and it's real and we have to think about it. So, for example, the FBI director was recently discussing a case of a homicide involving a woman named Brittany Mills. She was 29 years old. She was 8 months pregnant. She was answered the door one day and was shot to death on her doorstep. The police could find very little physical evidence. There were no eyewitnesses. Her 9-year-old daughter's upstairs, heard the shots, but didn't see anyone. And because she opened the door, there's some reason to believe it might be somebody that she knows. They then looked at who she had been texting and figured out that indeed there were certain people that she had been texting that day who might be suspects, but none of them stood out as being particularly relevant. But the family notified the officers who were doing the investigation that she had a diary and she kept it on her phone. And so access to the phone is going to be particularly relevant because it's likely that there will be evidence there that will give you some clue about where who is responsible. Was the phone backed up to the cloud? Yes, 3 months before, so not helpful. And so this is the situation that's being faced, and at this point, the investigating officers do not have access to the phone, and the case is unsolved. Now, one question is, well, is this just a unique case? And the answer is absolutely not. In fact, I would argue quite the opposite. How could this not be absolutely critical evidence in many, many cases across the country? Supreme Court has said, for example, the contents of our phone is in some ways more illuminating than the contents of our houses. And indeed, there are literally thousands of phones that have been seized in criminal investigations that are currently unable to be opened. Sometimes we'll hear the phrase, golden age of surveillance, possibly around it. Don't worry if you don't have access to this phone, or don't panic in the name of one of the reports that was done here. There's going to be lots of other ways, such as metadata. Out who's talking to whom, and that would be important and useful information that will take the place of the same information that was done as was the result of encryption. I think, A, I don't really think that's true, but B, this case really illustrates why that's not going to work. When you need evidence in a case, you need it in this case, and it doesn't really help, but we might be able to solve another murder in another state. In this case doesn't have that attribute, and so we need this particular evidence here. It's also interesting that we often hear about this in terms of the San Bernardino case, of course, prominent federal case with terrorism component to it. But really, in some ways, the state and local investigators are the ones that are taking the biggest hits because so much of what they do is going to involve regular stuff like obtaining evidence from an iPhone. So what I would like to pose as a question that the panel should be discussing, and that I would offer as something that you should be thinking about as you think through these questions, is, relatively speaking, what drop in security would result from us having a lawful access solution, a mandate, for example, to allow, require the ability to get into that? What is the relative drop in security of our devices on this side? And what is the relative harm to public safety and the system of justice on this side? That's the key question. Nobody's saying that we shouldn't have encryption. In fact, as we pointed out, we use it all the time. The government supports strong encryption across the board. That's a good thing. The question, though, is the drop in the security of our devices as a result of having a lawful access solution worth the cost over here? So I think that's a valid question, a valid policy question, and I hope we can get to some interesting discussion on this as we go forward.
Susan, can you weigh in on how do you view the major legal and policy issues surrounding this, and into the degree that you can, respond to what Richard was saying about how the issue of metadata and other investigative techniques aren't necessarily an offset for not being able to access encrypted communication?
Right. So I sort of approach this issue as fundamentally a question of our system of governance. And so the way I sort of think about it is we make these preliminary decisions. Whenever I say we, I mean all of us, right? We have a founding document, and then our courts sort of decide. Our legislature creates a set of laws, and then our courts decide how those laws apply. And that's the place in which we typically or have traditionally dictated what the scope of our privacy, what our relationship with our government is supposed to look like. And we're all empowered to set that sort of bar wherever we want to. And that's one sort of discussion to sort of to set to the side, right? What is the appropriate scope of privacy? What is that appropriate relationship? Then there's sort of working out the details. So it's not possible to sort of perfectly tailor lawful access to the scope of the Fourth Amendment. That wasn't possible before encryption. It's not possible now. That said, I think what we're seeing now is sort of a phenomenon that is really challenging the way we've gone about making these decisions, which is that we've set the scope of privacy. Our courts have come down and will continue to evolve, but have come down where they are on questions of probable cause and requirements for a warrant. And now we're facing a situation in which technology is exceeding those choices, and so we're faced with another choice. We can either say, no, we make those choices, and we understand that we might have to make, we might have to sacrifice certain things in order to retain that sort of core power, or we can say, no, we actually, we believe in the values of information security, or we want the free flow of innovation, or we believe that there are economic benefits, and therefore we want this technology to sort of move unimpeded by regulation. And so I think that the sort of important thing here is to recognize that there are these multiple threads. There's the thread of sort of the technical question. There is the legal debate about how our current laws, what the scope of our current laws can and should do. And then we have a policy debate about sort of whether or not those laws are a good or bad idea as sort of a larger regulatory matter. It's hard to have those conversations simultaneously, but while keeping them sort of intellectually distinct, I think it's why the issue becomes so incredibly confusing for so many people. But that's what I sort of view as kind of the core challenge here.
Kevin, is it either or? I mean, can you have encryption and still provide law enforcement with the information that they need for legitimate court ordered investigations?
In all cases, no.
Sorry.
In all cases, no. I want to talk about the policy question that's been raised here, and I like how Richard talked about it in terms of costs versus benefits. This debate about whether or not the government, whether the courts or Congress or anyone else, should be able to mandate that companies design their products in a way to ensure government access when the government comes knocking is often framed as a debate between security versus privacy. Susan did a little bit of that just now. I think that is a false frame that marginalizes the costs we would be looking at some sort of mandatory lawful access regime or exceptional access regime or what would colloquially be called backdoors. When it comes to the balance, to the costs and the benefits, I agree with former NSA and Director of National Intelligence, NSA Director and Director of National Intelligence Mike McConnell, former NSA and CIA Director Michael Hayden, former DHS Secretary Michael Chertoff, former CIA Director Michael Morell, and a whole bunch of people not named Michael, like former White House anti-terrorism czar Richard Clark, current Department of Defense Secretary Ash Carter, and many others, that ultimately we are safer thanks to the proliferation of strong encryption technologies, including end-to-end encryption technology, including full disk encryption technology like that seen on smartphones. This is apparently the view in the current intelligence community as well, based on Lindsey Graham, who recently changed his position on this issue, where he was supporting and now does not support backdoors, based on discussions, he says, with the intelligence community. And I think if you scratch the surface, other agencies in the administration as well, such as the Commerce Department, which is concerned about the impact on the economy, Federal Trade Commission, that's concerned about the impact on consumer security, the State Department, that is concerned about human rights and the security of dissidents in other countries, share many of the same concerns, but are seemingly less willing than the FBI is to go beyond the administration's stated position that this is a complex issue and they're not seeking legislation than the FBI feels able to do. But I would say that this position, that we are safer thanks to encryption, ultimately, is shared by essentially the unanimous technology industry, the security research community, privacy advocates, because privacy is a part of it, the human rights community, and the civil rights community. This is because this is not a privacy versus security issue. This is a security versus security issue, and in fact, it is an issue of law enforcement need in some particular cases versus our overall digital cybersecurity, the security of our digital ecosystem and our digital infrastructure and our critical infrastructure, our security against hackers and identity thieves and spies, both foreign intelligence agencies and economic. There's a physical threat as well that encryption fights. Encryption is a defense against the muggers who want to steal your phone. If all phones were by default encrypted, that would not be a profitable crime. Right now, it is our most common street crime. It defends the abused wife from being beaten because of the texts found on her phone by her husband. It protects the dissident in countries that respect human rights less than us from being tortured and killed based on what is found on their phone or what is in the instant messages that they send that are not encrypted. So I want to look at the costs and the benefits. I think there are enormous benefits from the widespread deployment of encryption. There are enormous costs to trying to break that. And I don't think there's an enormous benefit from trying to break that. If you look at the risk, the biggest risks, the one that is cited the most often, which is the threat of terrorists using encrypted applications to communicate with each other, U.S. regulation will do nothing to prevent that. There are, in fact, we wrote a report on this. It's called The Crypto Cat is Out of the Bag, where we looked at the top 9 applications that are recommended purportedly by ISIS. 8 of the 9 are either from foreign-based companies, applications like Telegram or Threema, which are based in Berlin and Switzerland, if I recall correctly, respectively, or are from open source code that no one owns, that is freely available. And indeed, jihadists have coded their own encryption applications. U.S. companies do not have a monopoly on this technology. It is essentially math, and we cannot stop math. What we can do through bad regulation is undermine our own cybersecurity and our own safety. So I would like to talk about the costs and the benefits, and ultimately I would love to talk about that particular murder case, which is from my hometown in Baton Rouge. And I'd love to talk about the Feinstein-Burr bill, which I think should be the center of the conversation at this point.
So we've heard the arguments for why encryption is so important, but also, you know, those are the challenges that law enforcement is facing. And I want to ask all of you, so what should be done at this point? Obviously, there's calls for creating a commission to look into this issue, and all of you or any one of you could actually be on that commission, so I want to get your perspective on that. But Richard, I just want to ask you just kind of immediate question about the FBI director said yesterday that they that the FBI has spent more than he makes, even in all of his salary, to buy the hacking tool to get into Farouk's iPhone, which is more than $1.3 million. And so, you know, paying more than $1 million for a hacking tool, you know, that's a lot of money, obviously. Was it worth it? What value was gleaned from being able to get into that phone?
So I can't talk about the particular phone, and the investigation is still ongoing, so I'm not in a position to talk specifically about that. But I think your point raises a particular instance of the inevitable result of having end-to-end encryption without any lawful access solution, which is that there are going to have to be efforts made to solve these problems. The public safety and the national security issues are going to have to be addressed. And so there will be a desire on the part of the government to purchase, even at quite a great expense, the ability to access these phones in order to keep people safe. Is this the world we want to live in where there is a market for vulnerability that is built around the idea of this, the need for access to these devices? If there was a lawful access to this device, there would be no incentive for the government to hide this vulnerability from Apple. In fact, likely had to turn it over in order to get everyone's phone to be safer. So I think it's an interesting offshoot of this whole question of if we restrict something here, inevitably there's going to be implications in other places that may not have been predicted.
Matt, is it possible to actually design a system that can have strong encryption with access?
I mean, the thing you need to understand is that a warrant is not some kind of mathematical cryptographic object. It's a piece of paper. And ultimately, you take that piece of paper to a human being who sits in front of a computer and then types in something after seeing that unlocks your phone or unlocks your messages. Now, the question is not whether that warrant was lawfully obtained. Of course, let's assume that it was. The question is that person and that system that they're typing into, is that thing secure? Because if they can enter the ability to unlock your phone, then anybody who accesses that person or accesses that system can also do it. And this isn't theoretical. Excuse me. We know that in 2009, the wiretapping systems that are located in Google's network were compromised, presumably by the Chinese. I think that's the understanding. We know that very recently, Juniper Networks, which is a company that did not have a built-in lawful access system, but had built a system very close to that in the sense that there was a backdoor in their system that was it was repurposed by hackers. So we know that hackers are looking for these vulnerabilities. Now, just to address something that Richard just said, yes, you're right. There are people out there looking for vulnerabilities, and the FBI is hiring those people. And that makes me a little bit sad. But at the same time, the solution to that is not to introduce new vulnerabilities. Because for every new opening you add three new inadvertent flaws, just like the one that was exploited on the Farouk iPhone. And maybe sometimes that's good, maybe sometimes that gives the FBI access, but a lot of the time it gives other people access, and these are not people we want accessing our systems.
Chris, can I
respond?
Make a couple of points here. One is that you've heard various of us talk about the word backdoor. That's one of those words that until fairly recently meant a surreptitious backdoor that isn't available to the ordinary person that's written by the programmer. Only very recently did that word come to become the majority of an ability for the government to access something. So I'll just put that in as a little bit of a footnote here. If backdoor means the ability to access information is stored on a system, that means necessarily that when a company builds in a system on their laptops or their iPhones to allow them to get into that employee's phone if they happen to die or get hit by a bus or whatever, then they've introduced that back door into the system. Similarly, if a webmail provider accesses your email in order to be able to sell ads for you, even if they encrypt it between you and that provider, and even if it's encrypted on the device, then that's a back door for these purposes. And so I guess I would say, in this question, is it possible to encrypt, to create a lawful access solution here that would be indeed quite secure? And what we drop in security that results from not introducing such a thing, I suspect that's a pretty small difference. Big companies introduce this back door all the time. In fact, Apple sells a system called Mobile Device Management, which is built exactly for this purpose, to allow employers to control the devices of their employees. Having the ability to look at that data also allows for better selling of ads and better blocking of spam and better restrictions on malware. So the fact that there are a very small handful of instances where there is a lawful access solution that has been attacked is hardly a reason to say we should just toss all this out. This is a vulnerability that is introduced all the time for practical, useful reasons like data recovery and selling ads. And if it's good enough for that, I think the benefits that we are seeing should be good enough also for protecting public safety and solving crimes. Put another way, it's not as if we're going from 100% security down to 50% as a result of creating this back door. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but I would submit to you pretty small because we do it all the time. Companies do it all the time in order to do that. And how do we're not dealing with 100% security anyway. The Symantec report last year says we're getting one new zero-day vulnerability every week. It's a little bit like we have a house which has a front door that's locked, but we leave all the windows open. And if you're worried about burglary, do you worry about whether the front door has a good solid deadbolt while the windows are open, or do you want a retina scan on that thing? This is the drop here is the question, not whether encryption is a good thing. We all agree encryption is a good thing.
Just let me respond to that.
I find it odd to argue that because there is no perfect security, it's okay to therefore reduce security further. And also, I think we've been using the term backdoor for mandated government access that would otherwise not be built into a product since at least the 90s. So it's not a new thing. But I want to respond especially to an argument implicit in what Richard said. Richard noted, for example, that a lot of us use email that is encrypted to the server between us and the service, like Gmail, but is not encrypted end-to-end between us and the person we're communicating with. And I think the argument there is, well, why can't everything be like that? If that is secure enough, why can't we just have no iMessages or WhatsApps and just have everything be architected like Facebook messages or Gmail? Yes, that is a somewhat reasonably secure mode of communication, but it is certainly less secure. As anyone who works at Sony will tell you, I bet the people at Sony wish that they had used secure end-to-end messaging for much more of their communications, which would have eliminated the risk of someone breaking into their system and exfiltrating their emails. I bet that the many young women who had their naked photos stolen off of iCloud and posted to the public web would have, in hindsight, preferred to have had access to fully encrypted end-to-end communications. The FBI director has framed this as a business model choice, saying that, well, these companies are just choosing to have a business model that is more secure because I guess they're just money grubbers or something, rather than companies offering a range of security for a range of types of communications, which I think is wholly appropriate and important. There are going to be services that you want that can't be affected if you have end-to-end encryption. It's harder to search your stuff. It's harder to get spam filtering. It's harder for them to give you a free service to serve by serving ads against it. But that doesn't mean that all communications products ever should be reduced to that level of security. I think that would be a very bad result for our security. And I think it would be a very bad result for our economic security if U.S. products were all made to do that. And then you would see foreign companies and foreign countries swooping in and serving that need for more secure solutions in a way that U.S. regulation will not reach.
I want to open this up to questions from the audience as well. I'm going to ask Susan and Matt, do you respond to anything that you've heard, but also, is part of this just a losing battle, just the way technology is going, that you have more and more companies that choose to design their systems that don't provide any kind of access, and to try to tell them that they retroactively have to build access in is something that is not really feasible. But anyway, anything you want to respond to?
So I think one of the real perils here is whenever we attempt to oversimplify tremendously complex both problems and potential solutions. Kevin is sort of responding to the notion, I think, sort of put forward by the Burr-Feinstein legislation of, we'll have sort of a performance standard, and everybody will have to find some way to produce, intelligible data. There's a full spectrum of options here. So there's sort of the lawful hacking, which a bit of what we saw in the San Bernardino case, right? The FBI either originally attempting to get the companies to assist them in hacking the devices, then going to the open market, right? So that's one potential area that we might go down that path. That might make sense. We might go down a performance standard path, and there might be good or bad reasons for doing that, and I'm sure that we are certainly seeing a robust presentation of some of the negatives there. There's also the possibility that we do nothing, but it would be wrong to believe that somehow meant that there was no trade-off there, or that the trade-off was purely one of information security. I actually fully agree with Kevin. This is not an issue of privacy versus security. It's an issue of security versus security, different types of security. The problem is that we tend to see, as a normative matter, sort of an equilibrium in terms of how these things work. So if technology ends up vastly sort of altering the landscape in which ordinary law enforcement operates, and I would suggest that ordinary law enforcement has a different set of equities than, for example, the intelligence community, if we do nothing, then we're likely to see pressures come to bear in other areas, like on Fifth Amendment protections. We're likely to see courts say things like, you can be compelled to put in your password or your thumbprint, right? And so we really have to be thoughtful and sort of responsible about taking really a much broader view of the pros and cons of a vast sort of spectrum of options here. And to sort of, respond specifically to two points that Kevin just made, I bet Sony systems, they wouldn't have been compromised had there been end-to-end encryption. They also couldn't have run a company. I can't think of any major corporation that is able to administer a large staff and coordinate without being able to access their employees' emails.
Suggesting they use only end-to-end encryption.
Right, but I think whenever we're putting up the specific examples of this wouldn't happen or that wouldn't have happened, it's important to sort of to give proper context of, if we're going to get into the specific, would this have made a difference? What actually happened here? Likewise with the celebrity nude photo hack in the plea agreement of that case, the individual who perpetrated it said that it was largely a phishing scheme, right? And so the encryption would not have been protective of that case. So I think that sort of it's just important to understand the complexities across the spectrum. That includes in the realm of human rights. Yes, it's important. We see all sorts of examples of why dissidents or people who are in repressive regimes need strong end-to-end encryption. On the other hand, we also see people who investigate genocide and mass atrocities that are coming up against challenges of accessing and investigating those types of crimes, which have tremendous human rights implications. We see civil rights consequences of this. So there's a case of a New York homicide in which an individual was actually headed down a path of wrongful conviction, and it was only by accessing, unlocking the phone of the actual perpetrator that the information came forward that exonerated this individual. And so I just, I would sort of caution away from sort of saying that this is the most extreme solution, these are all the bad reasons why we shouldn't do that, therefore let's do nothing, right? I think it's important just sort of to take a step back and really consider the pros and cons across a very large spectrum.
I wish the chair and ranking member of our Senate Intelligence Committee agreed with you.
Matt, you want to take a stab at this, and we'll see if we have questions.
So I think the only thing I would add to that is we've had a bunch of discussions up here of how you would build systems today in 2016 that protected Sony or protected iCloud users and so on. But these aren't the issues. I mean, it's 2016. We're not worried about 2016. We're worried about 2021 and, you know, 5 years from then. We're worried about what kinds of systems we will be able to build. We don't have the answers to building systems that are completely resilient against the attacks that you brought up. But in a few years, we will, unless somebody puts forward some very ill-considered legislation that shuts down entire areas of security research, in which case we won't. I mean, we won't. Other countries will. But we here in the U.S. could potentially cut ourselves off from all of those things. So the only thing I would like to at least conclude this with is that no matter what people say, encryption is the one technology in the field of computer security that seems to work. Everything else is a disaster. And so the reason that I'm so concerned about this is that if we're going to do something that weakens that, we are heading to a very bad place.
So are there... go ahead.
Okay. Can you just introduce yourself and then just ask your question?
Okay. My name is Courtney Ratch. I'm the Advocacy Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. And I think there are a couple of points that are relevant. I mean, you know, I think you're bringing up the law enforcement cases that have to do with terrorism, but then it's also important to look at marginalized communities or at, you know, particularly susceptible communities. So that includes, for example, Muslims, who might feel that they can't have the types of chats that they want to have or discussions or exploration of their political views if they can't do that safely because of surveillance and the ability to connect dots that create a picture that actually is not true. Or for journalists where we've seen the FBI, we've seen law enforcement impersonate journalists, we've seen them hack into journalistic systems. And I think just more broadly there's, and I'm just speaking for my personal opinion right now, a lack of trust in the Department of Justice because of the emphasis on, say, safety and security without recognizing that most of the, you know, terrorists, 9/11, Brussels, Paris, were under surveillance already or known to law enforcement. And so it really wasn't a failure of signals intelligence. It was a failure of human intelligence. And it seems to me that before we, you know, create some sort of unintended consequence, you know, about doing away with encryption, that we want to, you know, really grapple with how does law enforcement do a better job with the tools it has. And so I'd just like to, you know, bring that up because I think that, you know, in the whole, we also shouldn't be having this debate separately from the countering violent extremism debate because they're all related. And you can see, for example, the unintended consequences of, you know, U.S. government and other governments pressing social media firms to take, you know, so-called terrorist content offline is pushing them into the encrypted areas that you guys don't have access to. So,
do you want to respond?
14 things there. I'm not sure if you're able to hit them all. I welcome having all aspects of this debate and, frankly, this balance being considered as a result of this. I'd like to think, though, that it ought to be properly characterized as far as the ability to access things is indeed, as it started with, courts making decisions based on the law and the Constitution, balancing indeed the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment in figuring out these questions. And so under existing rules, we already have in place a very robust and constitutional-based system to try to decide these questions. What we're, our perspective is that we're concerned that that's going away. I think one important question that we need to ask is, who gets to make a decision about whether government should have access to a particular device? Is it the individual? That sounds great if it's you and you're thinking about, gee, I don't know, I don't have access to my data. It doesn't sound quite so good, though, when you're a victim of crime or when a member of your family is a victim of crime and suddenly that is necessary. So I guess the question is, do we really want criminals and terrorists to be able to make this decision? This is one of those things that economists call sometimes negative externalities, when, you know, the business is polluting the stream and harming others, the government steps in and says, sure, it's maybe good for one purpose, but it also having this other effect, and we need to take all those things into account. You know, the same is true for insider trading and child labor laws and all sorts of other areas, antitrust. Why are technology companies different than all the other industries where the government has said, look, we need to take in more into account than just the decision that you're making about whether you want to be able to sell ads or you want to be able to sell your product as one which is unbreakable by the government. So the question is, the individual or the courts? That would be the other choice. Do we want to reserve the power for a decision to be made based on law and constitution and by independent judges rather than the individual who maybe has committed a crime or acted terrorism?
If I could just make sort of a follow-up point as well in terms of sort of the point about inequality across communities, I think that this actually does get to one of kind of the central challenges here, and that is whenever we allow sort of particular types of technology, and it's not just sort of the encryption itself, right? It's also it's the accessibility, it's the default, it's how sort of easy a device is to use, etc. We know that those things, as a normative matter, are not equally distributed across communities, and so the reason why we decide that whether or not the cops get to look in your phone is based on sort of a neutral set of principles that apply to all of us and not whether or not you can afford a $600 phone is because we want to preserve sort of the equality across communities. We don't do it perfectly, but that's sort of that's the aim here. And so that can be mitigated somewhat by sort of free third-party apps. The problem is that there's also inequality of technological education and sophistication. And so one of the reasons, sort of in all different realms of sort of governance, in which we see a need or an interest for a regulatory regime is whenever we see that sort of the market is creating inequities that don't feel comfortable to sort of the core values of our system.
Kevin, if you want to weigh in on this issue of who should make the decision, and also if you can, because one of the questions is also, what is Congress going to do, and what we know is that Bernd Feinstein introduced their bill, and what's your take on their bill?
Sure, and I think these two issues go together to some extent. I think that in a democratic society, particularly ours, we have to be branches of government that make decisions, and I think that's perfectly appropriate. I think the characterization of companies as being some sort of anarchists who are defying the courts is ridiculous. The question of whether Apple can be compelled to do what the government wanted it compelled to do is an open legal question. They went to court to challenge it. That's called due process. That's not called defying a court order. And that's why I find the title and messaging of the Complying with Court Orders Act from Senators Feinstein and Burr to be disingenuous. It is not simply saying there is an existing court authority to do something that is very clear and we are just ensuring you can do it. They are saying it's actually, what is true is that it's actually unclear what that obligation is. We are going to enforce the maximum possible obligation on you in this regard. This is actually a huge new regulation that would force essentially any manufacturer or licensor or offerer of any digital technology product or service in the country to engineer their products in a way that that on demand they can provide plain text of anything they had a hand in encrypting to the government. Even Director of the FBI, Mr. Comey, agrees and has made clear this is a complex issue where there is no one-size-fits-all solution. And yet, Senators Feinstein and Burr have doubled down on the broadest, vaguest, one-size-fits-all solution possible. And so we think this, I was, for better or for worse, widely quoted saying this was ludicrous, dangerous, and technically illiterate, and was essentially the worst technology policy proposal I've seen in my entire career. I was not attempting to be mocking. That's literally true. It's the worst bill I've ever seen. And we need to have, if we're going to have a serious conversation about this that weighs the equities, that bill is not it.
Richard, I know you're not going to weigh in on the legislation, but just the idea of telling companies that they need to comply with court orders, obviously that's DOJ's position is when you have a lawful court order, companies should comply with those orders. But doesn't the other side have a legitimate argument to say that should companies be compelled to build something into their products or devices that that they didn't plan for, that's not part of the business model?
So I think this raises a very interesting question that is one that we really need to grapple with, and that is, who gets to decide what the rules are going to be? And I think there are three actors in this dialogue that could be the ones to decide. One is the courts. So I have no problem with Apple raising legal objections and due process and working through the courts. However, the courts are limited because they only have the law that's before them, and we haven't really talked much about the actual statutes that they're applying, but they're going to be bound by whatever their legal judgment is and the scope of those. The second party that could make this decision is the technology companies. If nothing is done, then the technology companies will decide who it is who gets access to these phones. Is it the criminal, the user of the phone in one category, or is it the Constitution and the laws of the United States in the other category? If we do nothing, that decision will be made by the companies. Or the third person that can make this decision is Congress. And so, although the administration doesn't have any position yet on the Burr-Feinstein bill, Congress is in a better position in many ways in that they have a full range of policy solutions that they can decide on. They, of course, are democratically elected representatives, and they are at least in a position to be able to weigh all of these different equities in a way perhaps that courts and technology companies are not. Listen, I have nothing against technology companies, and I certainly said nothing to think that would vilify them. We can expect them to make choices that are going to be valuable for themselves. That's what they do. But we should not expect them to make decisions that take into account the full range of equities here. That's not their job, and no harm in that. But I do think that as a society, we need to decide how we're going to make this decision. And at the end of the day, we ought to be able to hold our heads high and say, yes, it was worth it to lose this sort of privacy security side of things in order to benefit this physical security side of things, or we're happy to take the fact that our criminal justice system is less effective than these crimes have to be because there's greater benefits on this side. So that's, I think, the sort of, I think, key question here that we should be thinking about.
Susan, this is a little bit of a curveball question, but given your background coming from the NSA, you know, some people have questioned what kind of capabilities the NSA would be able to provide to, like, the FBI or, you know, local law enforcement. What's the thinking there? What are kind of the parameters in which the NSA, given its significant capabilities to, you know, to do foreign intelligence collection, to deal with incursion, what are the parameters?
So look, I can't and won't comment on any sort of specific capabilities of the intelligence community, but I think that there is a little bit of sort of magical thinking going on when it comes to the NSA, and it's sort of ironic because sometimes they're incompetent and these terrible idiots, and sometimes they're these like magical wizards that can do anything in the world, right? The NSA does a specific job; they do it pursuant to a specific set of authorities. Those authorities are quite different than those that we use in the domestic arena for domestic law enforcement. There might be, if we are going to have the intelligence community sharing or developing tools with law enforcement, there are incredibly complex legal and policy challenges there, and it's one that the American people should think very, very hard about. I think that if we're going to questions of sort of, if we are going, attempting to restore the trust between the United States, the people of the United States and the intelligence community, involving them further in sort of domestic law enforcement, I would not think that that would be sort of a positive thing, but we could have that conversation. Sort of the other thing that's been often put on the table is this question of sort of empowering the FBI to become like the NSA, right? You throw a bunch of money at them, you throw a bunch of technological expertise, and they fix the problem. Sure, that's one way to go about it, and we can fix probably some of the problem, but we can't fix all of the problem. And so I think it's really it's important to not wish away one another's concerns here, right? It's important for the government not to say, oh, you Silicon Valley, you guys are so smart, you can figure it out, you can find some way to do this without. You have to confront. No, if you have mechanisms of lawful access, that comes with potentially mechanisms of unlawful access. You know, so one side has to confront the other side's problems. That said, I'm cartooning kind of Silicon Valley or sort of encryption advocates, also can't assume away the problems of law enforcement by saying, oh, you know, refrigerators will have sensors in the future and that'll catch all your bad guys, or the NSA can break the phone, right? we have to stop this sort of this magical thinking and get down to these are the problems, and it's really a question of which bad things are we willing to live with. And that's an uncomfortable and unpleasant reality, but it is the situation we're in.
When in the process, are we going until 1:15, or what's the...
Yeah, we're going to wrap up till 1:15.
1:15.
Matt, if there is anything that you would, let's say that there is a commission that's created to look at this issue, what would be the biggest recommendation that you would make to them?
Take your time. I mean, really, this is not an issue you can come up with an answer to quickly. This is probably the most complicated issue that you're going to face. Well, not necessarily, but one of the more complicated issues you're going to face, at least in the technology area. I think that the longer you investigate this, the more you investigate the follow-on results of passing legislation and seeing what that legislation looks like, the problem is just going to get thornier. The only way you can think this problem is simple and something you can wrap up in a 10-page bill is if you haven't thought through all of the implications very carefully. So I would ask that whoever is legislating, take that time.
So I'll just see if we have any additional questions. Yeah, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah.
Please be brief on your question.
Sure. I'm Max Rosenbaum, reporter from Mother Jones. There's been a lot more talk as time's gone on in this debate about waffle hacking, and Susan's just talked a little bit about that, so I wanted to ask. I feel like it's being brought up as a solution that may kind of, in a way, end run a lot of these issues by giving your kind of technical capabilities, but it seems like every different player in this debate has a different major problem with it or a major concern. So I'd be curious for everybody on the panel to kind of say what would it take, whether it's law, whether it's procedure, whether it's something else, for you to be comfortable with the idea that the government will be given these technical capabilities, that waffle hacking is kind of the way to work through this problem.
I would love to talk about that. I mean, government hacking is a difficult issue. I think the privacy and civil liberties community obviously has concerns with it as a tactic. Then again, a number of noted security experts have suggested that it would be preferable to focus on targeted exploitation of bad guys' computers than it would be to break security for everybody through some sort of mandate, which I think is a compelling argument. But it's a very complex issue, and one that Congress is actually going to have to grapple with, because the fact is, the FBI has been hacking into computers for a long time. You can go and look at a great Wired story from 2009 where they FOIA'd some documents. And in 2002, there was an internal FBI memorandum complaining that the tactic of breaking into a computer to find out what its IP address is when it's using a proxy, they were already concerned about the overuse of that technique in 2002. We didn't even know they were doing that until it became public in 2007. The first time we had a court decision about the legality of that was in 2013. So there has been this process, this very popular investigative technique, that we have not had an above-board policy discussion about, and Congress certainly hasn't. And so we have not taken a position that government hacking is never appropriate. We haven't taken a position that it is ever appropriate. What I do know is that the FBI is doing it, and if we are going to allow that, we need some clear rules for the road that we don't have right now, akin to what we have for wiretaps, which are also extremely and uniquely invasive. I think that your answers to the questions about government hacking will turn on a variety of things. I think that remote access of a computer raises a lot more risks, for example, than the government trying to hack into something that they have seized and are in possession of. I think that the government using a known exploit on an insecure system raises less issues than the government using a zero-day unknown exploit, because when they're holding on to that zero-day, every day they hold on to it is just another day it's not getting fixed. And I would liken that to the government discovering a disease, and instead of sharing that with the medical community so that we can come up with a cure, weaponizing it instead. I think there are concerns about that, and I think those are discussions we have to have, and it's a hard one, but Congress has to have it, and they have to have it this year, in fact, because there is a proposed amendment to Rule 41, the search warrant rule, regarding remote access searches, that I believe has just been approved by the Supreme Court after consideration by the Judicial Conference. I think it will be transmitted to Congress within the week. And then Congress will have 6 months to decide whether it wants to act to stop or change that rule or let it go and have it automatically go into the federal rules. And so this is an issue that Senator Wyden has raised that he wants to talk about, and you're looking forward to talking about it as well.
Let's just do final comments from Richard, Susan, and then.
I guess I would actually like to respond to this question and my final comments. From the law enforcement perspective, we're not happy about hacking as a solution either. It's a hit and miss kind of thing. It's going to work sometimes and not others. One particular device in the was able to be hacked into in the San Bernardino case. It's not going to be available for the next device. And so this kind of arms race is not any kind of solution that we can see. It's going to be something that inevitably we'll have to do if there's no other lawful access way into phones. I would strongly object to the idea that we don't have any rules about use of hacking by law enforcement. We have the same rules we have for everybody else. We have the Fourth Amendment. We have neutral and detached magistrates evaluating warrants before they're executed. We have suppression afterwards if any Fourth Amendment violation occurs. We have a vast array of rules which would apply equally here as they do in other contexts. And this Rule 41 proposal doesn't, in fact, say that you can or can't do it. It simply says which court is the one that you go to. So it's not a matter of, it's really a procedural question of which court do you go to. Let's make sure that we're doing this the right way, that we're using warrants appropriately, and that we're going after these things in that direction. So all the judges that have looked at this have said, yeah, that makes sense. It's been reviewed by many layers of the Rules Committee and now by the Supreme Court. And said, yeah, it makes sense to get the judges into this process. And that's what this rule amendment would do. And we think it makes perfect sense. And frankly, avoids the problem that happened last week, which was suppression in a case which resulted in, or may well result in, having somebody go free who would otherwise be convicted purely on the basis of whether the rules designated this judge as the right one to do it. So, interesting question. And anyway, I guess I'll be more than it.
Susan, final thoughts.
So I'll be very brief. You know, essentially just a plea for some thoughtfulness, sort of a little bit in tension with Matt's plea for time, which I know seems counterintuitive. The Department of Justice first mentioned this term going dark on Capitol Hill in 2010, 6 years ago. I know that this has just sort of burst into the national consciousness in the past couple of months. It has been an intense priority of the federal government in Silicon Valley for at least 18 months and really many more years than that. A lot of really, really smart minds have been put to this problem. And in some sense, what's sort of bursting onto the public scene is the inability to resolve some core values. And that's a good thing, right? We don't, we want all kinds of sort of policy snags and technical issues to sort of be worked out behind the scenes because we can't all be involved with that. And whenever those decisions hit questions that are really about fundamentally irreconcilable values or policy choices that are for all of us, and that comes to sort of the public, we need to make decisions about them. I wouldn't think that hasty legislation or simple legislation would necessarily be the answer. I think it's always good when somebody puts something on the table because then you can discuss it. It's not theoretical. It's not hypothetical. You can actually talk about the pros and cons of it. But I would just sort of... I would push back against sort of the sense that we haven't been thinking about this for long enough, and that some sort of beautiful, perfect solution is going to emerge, and ask people to sort of maintain that thoughtfulness of accepting one another's challenges, while at the same time being sort of brave and having the courage to stand behind their convictions and saying, I'm willing to give up this other thing because I think my thing is more important.
So I'll be brief too. You know, if you put me on the other side of this, obviously I have my opinions about the value of this kind of legislation. But let's say you put me on the other side. I worked for the FBI, and all I cared about was making sure that these phones were accessible. And you ask my honest opinion about it. I do not believe that you can stop this rollout of encryption. I think probably what we're talking about here is slowing it down by a few years. maybe that would be the outcome of the best possible legislation. You know, I think we should just keep that in mind. And I think that, you know, the cat is out of the bag. The crypto cat, I'm sorry, I have to say that, is out of the bag. But, you know, at the end of the day, these technologies are very easy to implement. Anybody can start up a new app like Telegram in a few months, have this out there. The things you would have to do to squash this are very extreme. So, anyway, that's just a further plea to my take your time argument.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. Definitely appreciated this. And it's a debate conversation that's going to continue in the courts and Congress and everywhere else. Thank you.
I know, I always have like microphone touching.